quick. Welcome to the House of the Rising Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And welcome, Bruce. Good morning, good morning.
Good morning, good morning. So, how about jumping right in?
Let's jump right in, yeah.
How about FAQ number 1174?
Okay. And do you have a link for me?
I do. I put it in the chat window.
Okay.
Let me
wander over. This, you know, I'm still not used to this Windows thing.
Yeah.
It is quite interesting to me, all the different various things that are included in Windows 10 that make it difficult for me to figure out where I'm at. But, it's such a gift.
Well, I think it's part of a much greater conspiracy. If you want to call it that, which is, you know, the
what
ego.
Is a great conspiracy?
Well, yeah. A conspiracy is something is actually literally breathing together, right? So it's all the different divided aspects of the ego breathing together for a shared purpose, but it's a shared purpose of dividing and confusing.
Oh, I love that. I love that. I mean, that's
right.
Really
I mean, if you think about, you know, Khan being with and Spira is breath, right? So, you know, in terms of, actually, it was interesting because I was watching, just flashed on a movie that I saw last night. My mom and her partner were watching Eye in the Sky, which is a movie about the drones and an international drone strike on a terrorist cell, basically, and then the legal and moral implications and all it was actually a political thriller as much as it was
a government conspiracy kind of thing.
Well, it was a covert operation. So it was basically, but it was using drones of various scales, all the way down to things the size of a beetle, you know, with a camera, all the way up to, you know, the things that are 20 miles up in the air and out in what we would call outer space, you know, kind of thing. Whatever the altitude, I forget the exact altitude, but anyway, that these things are. You know, or doing their surveillance and then also armed with missiles and so forth. But it was interesting to just think about how the extent to which we have made a complicated and fearful world. And I was talking after the movie was over, the other two people in the room and about, you know, how I'd heard a podcast or not, well, radio shows, podcast, whatever, doesn't matter, by someone who lives in one of the countries where they have frequent drone strikes, and they were talking about how much they appreciated cloudy weather now because they know that they won't be concerned about a drone strike during cloudy weather because it's all about visual, you know, from satellite surveillance, basically. You know, it's essentially you know, the satellite surveillance and the drone surveillance that triangulates these coordinates for people that they want to take out. And I was thinking, well, wow, what an amazingly sophisticated nightmare, you know, that we've made up. And that's just one aspect of it. But the whole idea that there could be something that is subject to the whim of a belief in separation, you know, that the idea that something needs to be destroyed or killed or taken out in order for there to be peace. You know,
oh my gosh, this is, I'm sorry, you just made me think this is exactly what my thoughts are.
Mm-hmm.
My thoughts are drones.
Yeah.
And when I'm projecting out, you know, I want to kill you. Which,
yeah,
I have a lot. You know, I've got that killer instinct. But
we all do. I mean, what the Course says, what's not love is murder, you know? You know, any fearful thought is a murderous thought. And it's hard, you know, for especially, you know, as a beginning Course student to wrap your head around that. But that's really the essence of the insanity that the Course asked us to gently look at. And fortunately, we don't get the whole curriculum, you know, in one dose. We get to apply it over time. But the idea is to look at it and see, one, that it's insane, and two, that it never happened. And that if we're looking at a little fragment of all that is, then we're not seeing the whole picture. And anytime we look at bodies and personalities and separate interests and, you know, what's in it for me and why I can justify destroying or cannibalizing or otherwise wiping out or taking out what I consider to be an enemy or an adversary or something polarized to my, just doesn't agree with my thinking, or condemning with judgments, let alone with, you know, covert or overt action. And it's just fascinating to watch the mind and see how insidious and how, like you say, it's our thoughts. You know, those are the drones. Those are the armaments, the hungry dogs of fear and the weapons and the swords and the the missiles and the everything in between. You know, the whole shebang is basically geared toward seek and destroy in order to overcome and claim an alien turf as our own. We think that somehow we're going to benefit by condemning or attacking or judging or having less than peaceful thoughts about anything that seems to be outside of ourselves, which is just nuts, isn't it?
It's the ego's whole thing of it's us or it's me or you. Yeah. You know, that's it. You know, and that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
See, this is the absolute truth. It is either you or me. And if I don't see
in ego's thoughts,
yeah, yeah. If I don't see that we are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no distance and there's no difference, and that the drones that I'm sending out are only coming to me. Mm-hmm. You know, all these drones of thought, they're not going out and attacking some other. Mm-hmm. It's really attacking myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but unless you get the metaphysics that you and I are the same thing, and that, you know, I just thought of that old thing, I'm rubber and you're glue, but that's not really what it is. You and I are the same thing. So whatever I give you, I'm giving to myself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's a very deep thing to know, and it can only be understood conceptually by the mind, because there's no, you know, there's no way you can reconcile one and many.
Mm-hmm.
The mind can't reconcile one and many, and so it has to make provisions for the many, and being that the many seems to be other, that requires that it be destroyed, because that is the nature of the ego, is that the other always, it's always one or the other, and the other always has to be destroyed.
And you know, I'm glad you said the word mini, because I was just flashing on the character in the Austin Powers movie, Mini-Me.
Uh-huh. Oh, my gosh.
And I was thinking, well, that's what a great caricature of the ego. But it's a great pun, too, because Mini-Me, as opposed to singular me,
wow.
Singular self.
Yeah.
You know, and but that's our ego, is our Mini-Me. I mean, I think Gollum is another good you know, metaphor too, but in the Lord of the Rings, but you know, that the what's in it for mini me, you know. And but that's I just to touch back on that film again for a moment, because it was a very thoughtful, very thought provoking, but very even-handed film, because it showed the compassion of all the players involved in this international decision-making process, without giving the plot away, there was just, you know, there was a lot of it was around the collateral damage and how can they justify the strike given the likelihood of collateral damage, and you know, I'll try to stop the spoiler alerts right there, because it's worth seeing, and I think, you know, people who are listening might enjoy seeing it. It's not obviously not a lighthearted film at all, but the outcome, if we think in terms of the outcome of realizing the extent to which we've bought into the dream, and that's where movies like that really suck you in, and you get really involved in the characters, and you know, there's enough character development, there's enough story there that it's real easy to get sucked into that story and see that, you know, wow, that, you know, there's lives at stake and yada yada, and of course that's what we think we are. We think we have lives that are at stake, and on the level of form, sure we do, and it'd be silly not to you know, behave in an appropriate manner that with compassion, as this film demonstrates that there was plenty of, and plenty of angst and you know, the looking at the ontological guilt, not necessarily directly in this film, but you know, it gives us that opportunity. But there's plenty of opportunity in every moment to look at things that we invest in, involved in just keeping our, just for starters, keeping our individual bodies alive and functioning on a daily level. I mean, it's huge. And the self that we think we are, the persona that has its separate interests and wants to be loved and appreciated and respected and considered and heard and all that. And it's like, wow, if you think about the extent of the plot, if you will, that the ego has concocted, that the storyline, the screenplay, it's just phenomenally complex. And the links to which we create these drone thoughts, if you will, like you said, Lynn, that the elaborate measures that we go to try to take out or to annihilate things that don't agree with our separate self is just phenomenal. It's just astounding. So anyway,
because it is, this is the nature of the ego and this is the nature of the world.
Yeah.
That if you understand that, just understand that, just look at things from that perspective, then that whenever something is happening, to be able to look at it and say, this is the nature of the world and this is the nature of the ego, this is why I don't want to align myself with that. Not because I'm, you know, afraid of, you know, accidentally murdering a whole hospital or school room full of children, when I sent off my drone thinking, the idea is that I don't want to leave any damage. I don't want any collateral damage. Mm-hmm. I want to move through the world in a way in which I'm not, sending out those, you know, or, you know, chasing around with those hungry dogs of fear. Mm-hmm. I'm actually just living in a peace with everything around me because I see that it's all only here to be instructive to me about my own thinking.
Right.
The only purpose of the world now is for the Holy Spirit to show me, here's the result of your thinking. Here's what happens when you do this.
Yes.
So I can choose again and choose again and choose again. So when you see those kind of things, these movies and things like this that are really kind of made, they could be made to incite thoughts and fears or they could be made to just inform, however they do incite thoughts and fears, whatever it is, instead of being fearful, instead of being guilty, which that's the thing that, you know, when you start talking about drones and you start talking about, you know, how we choose elaborate ways to murder people, that has got to bring up deep guilt, mm-hmm. you know, because we're trying to annihilate the other, and
right.
that brings up deep
right.
guilt. And that, and unless you address that part of it and recognize that it's, again, nothing is really happening, and all of these situations are a part of the script, and all of these quote-unquote others are also actors, just as I am
mm-hmm.
in the script. And
exactly.
therefore, to have it's one thing to have empathy and compassion, but it's another thing to have false empathy And the false empathy is when we look at it and say, this is tragic, my heart's broken, I can't go on, or I must protest, or I must fight, or whatever action I think I need to make. And if you feel compelled to make an action, please, please do. Mm-hmm. However, look at your motives. Why am I doing this? Am
right.
I doing this because I feel guilty about what's going on, and I, you know, I can't live with that guilt, and so things must change? Or am I doing it because, you know, maybe I'm guided to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And but look at your motives, because the guilt is the thing that is really going to decide, really, who you're doing it with. If you're doing it with the Holy Spirit, you're not going to feel guilty.
Yeah, and I'm glad you
said you're not going to act to guilt.
Yeah. I'm glad you said the word guide, because I was just kind of thinking on the fact that there's two 5-letter words that start with GUI, and one is guilt and one is guide. Well, there's probably others, but I think they both have 5 letters. Yeah. Anyway, it really does boil down to those two thought systems, doesn't it? And which guide we choose, either, you know, what we call the Holy Spirit, or our inner kindness teacher, or Jesus of the Course, or, you know, whatever label or symbol it works for you, you know, whether it's Muhammad or Buddha or Jesus or you know, some other symbol that you know represents to you unconditional peace and uncompromising kindness, that doesn't exclude anyone or anything from that that inner embrace of our identity. That's, you know, that's a very radically different guide than the usual thought system that the world would endorse and embrace. Not that there's a way possibility of embracing that fully, because it's always a partial thought system, which is the thought system that says that, well, my interests are more important than your interests. You know, some animals are more equal than others. To paraphrase Orwell, you know, that we think that there's somehow a justification for differences, and that's one of the things that I think this movie very poignantly and powerfully conveyed is how insane the ego's thought system is, and if we can look at it as a metaphor like that, rather than, you know, like you say, getting so wrapped up and identified with the plot and the characters and seeing ourselves as one of them, which is obviously real easy to do. But I think, you know, cinema can be a very powerful tool to look at the contents of our mind. And with that, again, having chosen that teacher that makes all the difference in the world, the teacher of kindness, to look at and say, wow, here's where my thoughts of the belief in differences and the belief in separation and the belief in that, you know, and that judgment is warranted and justified, and that attack is justified because it's the same thought system. It's just, you know, different garb. If we can look at that without condemnation and see, hey, that's never worked for us, and it's a dream, it's a movie, it's a script, and something that never happened in truth. And we may not know what that truth is, because, you know, we're so far down the rabbit hole that it's like, it's, you know, a strange concept to us. But there's that calling that says, wow, I know somehow that what I'm watching is part of this elaborate movie. And I'm so zoomed in, like the drone cameras, you know, from outer space, you know, I'm so zoomed in that I can read how many stripes are on the military official's shoulder, you know, and see what rank that person is, you know, and do facial recognition, you know, and a little bit closer zoomed in stuff, you know, to positively identify a target. You know, it's like, well, gee, that's all part of the thought system that says that differences are so important, and the lengths that we go to develop that capability in the mind, of which the technology is just a reflection, that says I can discriminate between good and bad, and that you know, but we don't even question the fundamental idea that there is within the dream a difference between what we consider good and what we consider bad. You know, Shakespeare said it nicely, that there's nothing good or bad, that thinking makes it so. And I think he was referring, obviously, to all the different variations of the ego's classifications, because the ego wants to divide perfect oneness and doesn't know how to do anything but division. And that's
right.
That's the craziness, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, those are the ego's tools, actually. Multiplication and division.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the same outcome. They seem to be different mathematical operations, but in a sense, anything other than perfect oneness. I love how Ken Wapnick says, you know, that Jesus can't count past one.
That's a deep, deep, deep metaphysical thought. I mean, that's not just a funny joke.
Right.
A deep, deep, deep metaphysical thought. That's saying that, you know, this mind, when the Christ mind doesn't see differences. Mm-hmm. The Christ mind does not see man, woman, tree, dog. Those things are not being seen by the Christ mind.
Right.
Because it's impossible for the Christ mind to see these differences. Those are differences that are basically blocks to light. So when I see your face, it's blocking the light of who you are, what you are. Your body is blocking the light of what you are. You know, and so the Christ mind doesn't see the block.
Exactly.
And Jesus actually says that when you come to this place, you will only see a little shadow circling a light.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is an actual truth, that the only thing you'll know of this world is a little shadow, because that's really all there is of it,
right,
to be seen.
And yet the kindnesses, when we do choose against the ego and get those glimmers of what it's like to remember the kindness as an option, as the real alternative, which is the shared interest, that is the compassion that's also featured in this film. And you see the struggle with each of the characters, you know, dealing with their internal battle between those two thought systems, thinking that one could possibly, you know, the fraudulent one could possibly be real, the one that says my interests are more important than your interests, and we all embrace that in different ways, and we realize that, you know, there is an opportunity at every moment to choose once again to look at the craziness of the ego's thought system, that's the we they paradigm, and ask ourselves, is this really what I want? Is this, because we're not at peace when we, you know, entertain those ideas. There's no possible way we could be at peace when we believe that there's something or someone outside of ourselves, and that our identity is defined by that division. And that's just craziness, isn't it?
I mean, it is. Yeah. Well, and that is exactly it. That's the exact insanity that is, you know, it's our life. It's from the moment, you know, we first become conscious in the morning, and during our sleep, I'm sure, when I'm not paying attention to what's going on, those thoughts are going on all the time. These thoughts of differences are going on all the time. And it really is a, you know, a kill or be killed thing. If I'm sitting here, and I've had it happen many, 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 I'm sure you have too. You're sitting, you know, enjoying yourself, and all of a sudden you feel something on you, like a mosquito. You know, your thought is not, oh, Jesus is touching me on the shoulder, or, oh, the Holy Spirit is sending me a message. Your thought is, kill that sucker.
Or after watching this film, you might say, oh, I've got a small drone attack going on here.
A little drone, yeah. A little mosquito, a little drone. But, you are going to eliminate that thing, that foreign thing that has somehow or the other come to attack you. Mm-hmm. This is how these thoughts are.
Oh, yeah.
These thoughts are the same way. You know, they come in your mind. You know, you're looking at, you know, someone you love dearly, and you think, you know, I wish, you know, they weren't, you know, doing, you know, going out with that guy, or I wish they didn't have such a bad habit of, you know, picking their nose, or, you know, I'm trying to think of something that we would wish somebody wasn't doing. And, you know, every time you look at someone, even the person you love the most dearly, and you're thinking of ways that you wish they would change, mm-hmm. To better suit you.
Yeah.
You're killing them. You're murdering them.
Right. And that's one of those ideas in the course that at face value seems outrageous. And yet the first miracle principle right in the beginning of chapter one in the text is, you know, no order of difficulty in miracles suggests that what is not love is murder. And whenever we're not at peace, we're saying to ourselves, my investment of my identity in this illusion is more important than peace. And that's a tough one to swallow. But ultimately, I think we get a chance to look at that slowly over time and see and generalize by taking the little irritations and realizing, well, gee, I don't have to be upset by this. And we slowly but surely over time extract our identity and restore our identity. It's never been compromised or damaged or in any way diminished, except in our minds by the clouds we put in front of it. But we begin to reacquaint ourselves with that identity that is complete and healed and whole, that we never left its source in God's mind, and return to the oneness we never left by noticing each of those seeming attacks, seeming infractions, seeming violations on the perfect oneness that we made up on a script that we've forgotten that we wrote on some level, and not necessarily consciously, but we get to look at those things and say, wow, this is just an opportunity for me to be at peace again by looking at how crazy this is and choosing against identifying with it. Should we start in the question? I think it ties in actually pretty well.
I think it ties in perfectly. Yeah, I was just thinking that, hey, he's just getting ready to talk about this.
Yeah, do you want to read the question? Sure.
Okay, so we're on number 1174, and I did post the link in the room, but I'll repost it here because a lot of people have come and gone. And so if you want to follow along, here we go.
And I don't blame people who've left because this is a heavy topic.
Oh no! I'm telling you, it looks like the only people that have left have been people that are not used to us.
Oh well, that's why too.
We're pretty radical, right?
I
think we're talking insanity. You know, I've had it happen more than once where people have just come in and say, "You guys are cuckoo." You know, what are you talking about?
We're cuckoo for cocoa puffs.
God didn't make the world. What are you talking about? You guys are insane.
Yeah. How could you dare entertain that idea? Okay, anyway, we got a half hour left. Let's see if we can get through it. Huh?
All right, okay. Oh, come on. Stop cracking the whip here, Mr. Ego. Okay. All right. Oh. In Ken and Gloria's book, The Most Commonly Asked Questions About A Course in Miracles, they discuss the possibility that someone can be threatened by our quote-unquote peace. They were clarifying the line in the course that says, "We know we are truly at peace when all, or I think it might be we meet,
yes,
when all
yes.
we meet or even think of us share in our perfect peace with the anger directed toward Jesus." Let's see. I'm going to read that again. They were clarifying the line in the course that says, "We know we are truly at peace when all we meet or even think of, us share in our perfect peace with the anger directed toward Jesus." Ken and Gloria said that in order to become threatened by our peace, someone else would first have to experience it as real and then become threatened by it. Does this mean that the person who becomes threatened senses that we do not want to compete with them, but only want to be friends with them? Do they detect a sense of peace with ourselves? I just do not get why someone would be threatened by someone wanting to be peaceful with them. And I'm just cracking up at the question already because it does. It's, well, why would anybody be upset about perfect peace?
Yeah, how can that be possible?
It's not possible. But for me personally, here's a great example of how I will not accept that. When someone says to me, I am at perfect peace. This is heaven. I am in heaven on earth. I am living in a joyful condition. When people say things like that to me, I get pissed. I don't believe it. And I think, you know, you're a hypocrite. And I start going into all sorts of defenses and pulling out, you know, all sorts of evidence as to why you couldn't possibly be at perfect peace. And so, you know, right away, I'm ready to kill you for that.
So your ego mind has just said, as all of ours do, and we're all in the same boat, battle stations, man the drones, right?
Man the drones.
Or I guess now the gender neutral would be staff the drones, right?
Right, or arm the drones or whatever.
Arm the drones, yeah. Exactly, yeah, yeah.
But I do that exact thing. And, and in the past I looked at that and said, well, that's just good discernment. You know, that's good. That's proper perception. And yet, you know, I have no reason to disbelieve you. Mm-hmm. You know, if you say you're at perfect peace and you have achieved the peace of God, or you believe that you're in heaven here on earth, why wouldn't I be joyful for you?
Right.
And wishing I could get there, rather than trying to attack you and think that you're lying to me.
Right.
I don't know. Those are just thoughts.
Yeah, well, there's a whole bunch of different ego responses that could mix into that. Well, certainly jealousy comes to mind as, well, what if they really are? Then damn it, how come I'm not?
Right. Why don't I just get Ascended Masters on my couch?
Yeah, just for starters, you know, it's like, well, and then there's the they couldn't possibly be at peace because, you know, I don't think it's possible. But, you know, of course, the ego knows nothing of peace. So it is basically critical and suspicious of everything. And like the Course says, you know, the ego's range is from suspiciousness to viciousness. So, you know, and on its best day, it's suspicious. So that doesn't really necessarily even address whether or not the person really is at peace, whether it's, you know, perfect and unassailable peace or just temporary peace. It doesn't matter. But it basically, I think, was a good reminder that, you know, there really is no peace in the ego's thought system. And at best, there's just this uneasy, temporary lack of outward conflict. You know, there may not be a bomb going off or a missile, landing next to you or at you or whatever at the moment, but there's always this sort of Damocles thing of, well, yeah, okay, but the Monty Python boot may drop any moment.
Any moment.
And you know, because that's really the way, the nature of the world. We have no idea, because we're not omniscient, you know, what's going to happen next in the world. And so the world was made up to be a fearful place. And so on an unconscious level, we, you know, in our insane thought system as ego, you know, with emphasis on the S, the dualistic, you know, suffix there, that just defines more than one and the insanity that implies, that's, you know, by definition a fearful state, because there's always something out there that can get us, because we're not all there is in that thought system. So should I read the answer?
Well, and the whole purpose and the point of the ego thought system is to protect us from that thing that's out there,
right,
that we don't know anything about and we can't define. So
right,
ego really is like the protective mechanism that's mm-hmm. here to basically keep us from looking for other answers.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah,
it keeps us in the dream. It keeps us invested in the dream. The whole purpose of the ego thought system is to keep us invested in the dream so that we don't look outside of ourselves or look somewhere for something else. And it does a very good job of that. It has for, you know, how God only knows how many, you know, billions of years. And, you know, now, you know, people are looking at it and saying, well, you know what? I don't like the way that thought system operates because, you know, there seems to be no winners. It's, you know, the movie with Matthew Broderick. Was it Matthew Broderick? Where he's playing, he's a kid genius and he hacks into the Pentagon system and starts playing a game with the system that actually is set to decide whether we're going to war with Russia or not or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he gets caught up in the game and the computer won't stop. And it's going to actually launch missiles because what is the name of that movie?
I'm not sure if I've seen that one, but I think I've heard of it. But it's reminiscent of another movie that I was reminded of watching the Eye in the Sky movie last night, which, by the way, had excellent performances by Helen Mirren and Alan Rickman, I think it was his last film, and numerous others. Which is the Man Who Saved the World. I think we talked about that a few weeks ago, which is
a
true story. And if anybody hasn't seen that movie, that's also I would highly recommend that. Not a lighthearted or a kids film at all, but this Russian high military official essentially, again, also in this film, you know, basically went against the protocol and averted total global nuclear annihilation of the planet. And this is a factual.
That's a true story.
This is documentary because there was actually in that film, without going too far into it, was essentially the Russian military system back in the mid 80s thereabouts, I believe, had a computer system that made simultaneously five false positive indicators on their system of incoming missiles, and the Russian general, whose name I should remember because everyone should have it memorized.
I bet you Igor knows, and I think Igor's here.
Well, anyway,
what's the guy's name?
It's the Man Who Saved the World. You can Google it and find the movie, and it's excellent, and it's I think every human on the planet probably should watch it really because we owe a debt of gratitude to this man who violated the protocol. By saying that they weren't going to launch a counterattack based on their instrumentation until they had visual confirmation, and which kind of ties into the movie I saw last night, the Eye in the Sky one, until you know there was proof that there was a real threat. And I think that's a good metaphor. It's just like if we can wait until we see that there's a true threat to our identity and to our true identity, and of course our true identity cannot be threatened. Which means that there's the only response to fear is love. And if we have a call for love, which a seeming attack from outside of ourselves is, then the appropriate response is love. And if we have an experience of incoming love, if you will, then obviously the appropriate response is also love. So in either case, it takes the decision-making trauma out of our mind because there's only with that traumatized thought system neutralized by forgiveness, we're free to act in an inclusive manner and to behave appropriately. And even if that on the level of form takes a form that doesn't seem to some as loving, if the idea and the intent behind is inclusion, which I think this you know, film last night grappled with a bit. How do we serve the greatest interests of for the greatest number of people? Well, obviously, the Holy Spirit, that thought system includes everyone and everything, and that's the judgment that we can't make as individuals. So anyway, I'm gonna go ahead and read the first paragraph. But
okay. By the way, that movie was War Games. It's called.
Oh, War Games. Oh, yes, that's right.
War Games. Yeah. And the thing about the War Games movie was that he, when the computer just would not stop and was ready to attack, the guy who invented the program took the computer and went back to the very first thing that it had taught it in the program, which was the game of tic-tac-toe. And so it went through every permutation of the game of tic-tac-toe until it came to the final conclusion that there is no win-win situation. Nobody wins.
Uh-huh.
And when it comes to that conclusion that nobody can win, it stopped.
Oh, and that's great. What a great metaphor, too, because that's the whole undoing of the ego is to realize that there's no winning in the ego's game.
Yeah.
It's always lose-lose, because as long as any part of the sonship, to use a coarse term, loses, then everything loses. And that's the whole ego insane strategy, is somehow that part of perfect oneness could win at the expense of something else, which is crazy.
It is. Yeah. So go ahead and read, please.
Okay. Yeah. This is about the possibility that someone could be threatened by our, quote, peace, unquote. And then this is FAQ number 1174 in the FACIMOutreach.org questions, of which there are about 1,300 plus, and we're slowly making our way through a few of these. So the answer to this question number 1174 is, first paragraph, to understand the dynamics of the ego thought system at work, it is essential to look beneath the surface. For this purpose, a phrase used in the training of investigative teams applies aptly to the mind training taught in the course. Nothing is as it seems. It is insane. I can talk. It is insane to think that peace would be.
That was insane thinking.
Insane thinking, absolutely. It is insane to think that peace would be a threat in any way. Yet that is the ego's interpretation of anything related to the right mind of the sonship. The ego is insane. The part of the mind that chooses to identify with the ego thought system is threatened by the part of the mind that knows peace. Its foundation is threatened by the possibility that the decision-making part of the mind may make a definitive choice against it in favor of peace, in which case it will cease to exist. Well, doesn't that sound like the kind of battle that the ego tries to wage on the level of form instead of turning it back to the mind and realizing, oh, this is actually a choice between an insane thought system where there seem to be players and adversaries in the mind, and then when we look at it from above the battleground in the mind, we realize, wait a minute, whether it's on the level of form or on the level of the mind, in any case where there's a we or a they, we're basically engaging in the warfare of the egoic thought system that is always lose-lose, because perfect oneness doesn't have an opposite. And so if we divide perfect oneness, we've already lost. But nothing in truth has been lost. But we appear to have lost the perfect peace. So do you want to read the next one?
Yeah, absolutely. When peacefulness is perceived in someone else, it is a reminder that the same peace is possible for oneself. All is well if the mind decides to choose peace and identify with the peace it perceives in another. However, if it chooses to identify with the insanity of the ego, it will perceive anything sane as a threat. Fear then replaces guilt, replaces peace. Guilt for choosing fear instead of peace is projected out in the form of a judgment against someone who seems peaceful. And boy, isn't that just right? You know, don't you just, when you're having a terrible time and someone comes along and they're like oh, hey, what's the problem? I don't see anything wrong. Don't you just want to slap them? I mean, seriously.
Well, of course, it also depends on how they say it sometimes, right?
But yeah, when I'm having a bad time, you better be having a bad time too.
Misery loves company.
That's right. Otherwise, you're not my friend. So,
but it's not much of a love in that sense. It's really
no. There's no love involved.
There's no real love involved there. Yeah.
Oh gosh. So the judgment may come in the guise of envy, admiration, or a desire to bask in the comfort of the peacefulness the other possesses. Strange as it may seem, the ego always interprets this to mean, if you have it and I don't, you stole it from me. And that should say from, not form. And that reminds me of the movie Paper Moon. Do you remember the movie Paper Moon?
I think I might have seen it a long time ago.
Tatum O'Neill and Ryan O'Neill, and he's a con man, and she's his daughter, and he's just gotten her, and he's, you know, taking her on a trip, and she's he says something, she does something that he thinks is unethical, even though he's a con man and he's like just completely conning people all the time. She does something he thinks is unethical. And I think that's, oh, scruples. He says, do you know what scruples are? And she says, I don't know, but if you've got them, you must have took them from somebody else.
That's a great line. What a great line. Talking about oxymoron, huh?
That's so good. But that's it. If you have it and I don't, you stole it from me.
Oh, that's wonderful.
This is the projected version of the mind's judgment against itself for thinking it stole God's power by deciding to reject the identity given it by God and make up its own delusional separate identity. This hidden insane thought system is not visible on the surface. It is a disguised attack on oneself and the other person, masquerading as admiration or any number of quote-unquote acceptable sentiments. And think about this with the people that you quote-unquote admire in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Even that is pointing out you're different than me and we're not the same.
Yeah, yeah. And it could be anything from celebrities that we admire, and usually in some sort of enviable way. Or it could be people who we feel have attained some sort of spiritual, level of understanding or experience or whatever. You know, it doesn't matter. Anything that divides rather than unifies is fair game. It's not fair. It's an unfair game, but it's part of ego's strategy to keep the division, to keep the separation real.
Exactly. And yeah. I'm just thinking of, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking of a picture that people have been posting a couple times lately on Facebook of Ken, and Ken just looking just so peaceful and beatific, and thinking about how many people attack Ken. I know many, many, many people who think that Ken Wapnick was the devil because he destroyed A Course in Miracles. I mean, there's a whole faction of people who look at that. And I think, how can you think that? You know, have you met this man? Did you ever, you know, and it is because of that peace that just when you're not at peace and you see someone else who is, if you are not ready to accept your own responsibility for the way that you're seeing things, you're going to blame them and find fault with them and think that they're judging you and think that, I mean, that's a big part of it, is thinking that they're judging me. You know, who do you think you are? It's, man, look at your thoughts. I'm looking at mine and I'm shocking myself. So the Course teaches that any perception of difference is an attack. An attack engenders fear of counterattack. Thus begins the ego's endless cycle of perceived threats to be defended against, including someone else's peace. That explains the gnawing, pervasive sense of vulnerability that gives reason to elaborate plans for security. The ego is under constant threat and therefore in permanent defense mode because it is aware that any moment the mind that chose for it can abolish it by choosing against it. And the Course tells us this over and over and over, that, you know, once you figure out that you can get rid of this thing, it's going to want to kill you. So be prepared. Okay, that is why peace is perceived as a threat. It has nothing to do with the way another person behaves or what they say. It is the mind that chooses the ego that is threatened. It is the mind that chooses the ego that is threatened by the true peace abiding in the right mind, where the memory of God's love is held. And again, the only reason one would fear God's love is because the separate self cannot exist in the oneness of his love. And that's the point. You know, if I choose this, I will no longer exist as a separate being. The separate self will no longer be. And, you know, that, it's pretty scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And all of us who are identified with our separate selves, which I think probably includes about 7+ billion people most of the time, except in, you know, occasional lucid moments, you know, that's the default thought system. And that's this, the hungry dogs of fear that paradigm that basically goes out to attack and destroy and to, you know, increase our own little kingdom, which we think is huge, but it's really so tiny. It's really in the cosmic perspective, nothing. And yet we justify and rationalize and have statistics to back up, our attacks and our collateral damage, if you will, and like this film that I was talking about earlier suggests, you know, that we think that somehow we're okay if we destroy part of perfect oneness, that there's still going to be not enough left over for us to be happy. You know, it's like, what? You know, but that's the craziness of the ego thought system. We think that it's possible to, within a dream, and it's only within a dream, to carve out a part of perfect oneness and find peace in it. But just the very fact that we've carved something separate from something else, we've defined in our mind an idea of separation, there's no peace possible in that whole thought system. And it hates to have that pointed out, you know. That's why the ego goes from being suspicious to vicious when its thought system is threatened, and to be aware of that so that we're not blindsided when that retaliatory attack from that thought system starts, you know, immediately to be launched, you know.
Right. And I, you know, I envision the ego being like a shepherd dog, like we used to have an Australian shepherd, and that dog will herd you. You know, if you seem to be getting off the track, and you ever see these dogs with these sheep, man, they're, you know, going out and nipping at their heels and, you know, making them move and making them go here and there. And, you know, don't be the sheep that tries to go off into another direction, because that dog will be right after you. Mm-hmm. And that's how the ego is. It just keeps, yeah. You know, it keeps you in line. Mm-hmm. And it keeps you in line through threats, fear, pain, suffering, guilt, and love. It keeps you in line through the things that you love in the world, the things that you fear to lose, the things
and that's love with heavy quotes, right? I mean, love as the Course defines it, but it's what passes for love in this world. Yeah,
exactly. And that's another thing that you got to be really careful of, because for the most part, and I know it's difficult to believe it, but even, you know, I'm a grandmother. I have a little grandson who's the most beautiful creature on the earth, whom I would die for in an instant if it was necessary, or would do any good. I don't know. But, you know, here's something that I adore, absolutely adore. And the Course tells me, you know, that's not really love. Mm-hmm. Even though it appears to be, it is all very conditional. And it's something that was, deceptive, because you think that it's out of a purity of spirit, that I just love this creature, I love this character, and that's it. If it's the character that you're loving, then you're not even really seeing the being that is there. And if something were to happen to that character, then you would be bereft completely. But if you knew the being, then the character would have no meaning to you. Mm-hmm. And as much as you love the form of the character and his sweetness, you recognize that that's a shadow. That's a facade. And the truth of what he is so far beyond that. So, you know, that's, you know, my love for him is threatening to me. My love for him, you know, the ego tells me if anything happened to him, I would just die. I would just be so devastated. I could never live. I would have to, you know, take it out on everything in the world for taking away the most amazing thing I know. This is how the ego keeps you thinking that love is. But that's all complete. That's like codependency.
Oh yeah, and as you're saying that, I was thinking about some of the characters in this movie I watched last night, and I was thinking, well, how quickly we begin to identify with the characters we like, you know, out of the just on this planet alone, 7+ billion humans, you know, let alone all the other animals, vegetables, and minerals, you know, looking those other kingdoms, if you will. And we have such preferential biases about the and judgments around which ones are worthy of living and which ones should be taken out, you know, or is it okay to destroy, because we think that there's differences in the essence of each of those, and that's the insanity. We think that it's possible that spirit could have been divided and partitioned out in partial ways to seemingly separate individuals, and yet if all of spirit is in each seemingly separate soul, if you will, or body, you know, even further down into the dream, how could that be possible? How could that, how could perfect oneness have divided itself in such a way that there's, a reality to differences, and yet it's so convincing that, you know, we don't even question that.
We don't even question it.
Of course there's differences. Well, yeah, on the level of form, of course there is, and from the context of the dream, sure, yeah, you know, no one in their right mind would deny that, and that's not, as the Course points out, that's not the proper use of denial. But the right use of denial is to deny the thought system that suggests that spirit could be divided.
Exactly.
That perfect oneness could be divided, that what we call God or whatever label you want to put on it, that ineffable presence that indwells within all of us could somehow possibly have been compromised and split up and partitioned out, and certainly in unequal ways, warranting just attacks in heavy quotes, you know, it's just crazy. It's
crazy.
Totally messy. Yeah.
And you're reminding me of something. And I'm telling you that I wish when I was a sociology student, that we would have had things like we have nowadays as far as, doing video things. Cause I've seen several videos where, people have done, like this one was a little girl in, I don't know, some country, European country. Anyway, they took this little 6-year-old girl, and they dressed her up in really nice clothes, you know, beautiful hair, everything, and then sent her into a restaurant. And so she went into the restaurant, she was wandering around, and people were stopping her. Are you okay? Where's your mama? Are you hungry? You know, they're being really sweet and nice to her, and, you know, very kind. So then, you know, she comes out, and they take her probably on another day or whatever, and they dress her up like a street kid, and they put dirt on her. You know, they make her look grimy and grubby and not beautiful. And then she goes into the same restaurant, and people are like, you know, get out of here, get away from me. They're picking up their purses and moving them out of her way so that she can't be near them. And you know, finally somebody says something really, really mean to her and asks the wait staff, you know, take her out of here. You know, she's bothering me. And the little girl was just crying. I mean, she was hurt. Mm-hmm. You know, she was actually literally hurt by this because, you know, she was being treated badly and nothing had changed. But these social experiments are showing us, you know, the contents of our minds and how we may look at someone and think that, you know, because of they look, we make an assumption about who they are, where they come from, and how we should treat them. And another, you know, great example, and, you know, I don't want to get into this because this is a long, long subject, is I was watching one of these cooking contest shows, mm-hmm. and it was little children.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the, they were all like between 9 and 11 years old. These four kids, and there was one little black girl, and she was like a head taller than the other kids. You know, she seemed bigger and seemed older, whatever. And I was noticing how even people who were trying to be politically correct were addressing this child as, and this was a, like a 10-year-old girl. They're addressing her, in a way that, you know, made you think, well, it was different than the way they were addressing the little white kids. Mm-hmm. Let me just put it that way. And actually being tougher on her, like they were expecting her to be tougher in her, reactions because of, you know, because of how she appeared to them. You know, that was what it looked like to me, because I always noticed that for some reason people expect black children to be tough or black people to be tough. It's just when you look at them, you think, oh, there's, you know, they're different. They're different enough from me that, of course, not if you're black, but if you're white, it's this idea of difference that makes you suddenly suspicious and holding on to your purse and looking around for other, you know, people that might be there to help you in case these people attacked you. And, you know, they're just some, you know, young men walking down the street talking and being joyful with each other. And yet you become suspicious because of the way they look. Or you think that they're, you know, this is how insidious it is, because the truth and reality is there's no difference in any way at all between any of us.
Exactly.
And so these differences are, we make them up. We call it different and we see it different. But when did you start seeing those differences? I never saw those differences until I was, you know, much older and recognized that there were some people that people liked and other people that people didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And took a cue from that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I never took a cue to dislike people because of the way they looked, but that doesn't mean that there isn't some suspicious ego crap going on.
If you look at somebody
that looks different.
Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking as you're saying that, Linda, that if we were to look at questions about ethnicity and race, for example, and back it up to the optics of color, and when you have a camera, or whether it's a still camera or video, and you look at all the pixels in a digital image that are made, and you realize, well, the only difference is the intensity of the numbers that are representing, which are just, you know, any number other than one is basically a misinterpretation. If A Course in Miracles is right. So, you know, the fact that there may be, you know, higher or lower numbers representing a pixel in our mind about the color of someone's skin, it's just one more example of how crazy it is to reinforce the idea of differences. After John Stewart and, Stephen Colbert went off Comedy Central, I still watch The Daily Show and The Nightly Show every day, pretty much, just because I think there's a lot of really good information about what's going on in this country and in the world. And to me, it's an exercise not only in compassion, but also in mindfulness to see, you know, the craziness that's still going on. All the, you know, the you know, police shootings of you know, typically black people that are just unwarranted, just crazy stuff. But I think it's a good opportunity to not only keep our minds and hearts open, but also to see that all lives matter, and we can have, you know, we can support things like Black Lives Matter because of the imbalances without making the differences real. I think that's, you know, we can afford to be compassionate wherever it makes sense to us in the world without making a big deal about it. And realizing that there's inequities and on the level four, why not work to support the movements that, you know, restore justice without making the dream the big deal, but keeping in mind that the underlying unity and equality is what truly unites us. And that's where we see beyond the differences and see beyond the form, because, you know, like, you know, the phrase of the Course really distills all that into is nothing so blinding as perception of form. and projection makes perception. and it's just a feedback mechanism for a crazy thought that we made up that shows us that there could possibly be differences. Did we finish the second paragraph?
We finished the second paragraph.
Oh, okay, I thought so.
So we're ready for the third, yeah.
Okay. Do you want me to read that?
Yeah. Please.
Okay. Was there something else you wanted to say, Len, though?
No.
Okay.
You know, just the same general stuff that we're just talking about. You know, I'm just thinking of so many examples where, for me, personally, it is when you get to know people, and that means you have to spend time with people, and you have to be open to learning about people and to loving people. So, you know, if you spend a lot of time with people that seem to be like, you know, you grow up, you know, in your Singapore or something where there's, you know, multiple ethnicities that are, you know, all kind of equally part of the society. It's a different, you know, not that everyone is equal in Singapore. I'm just not saying that, but it's a different kind of a racial mix that, you know, some things are more acceptable than others. And, you know, you begin to see that there's the differences that we make between people and ethnic groups and social groups and everything are all just so artificial and untrue that, you know, you couldn't possibly then select anyone from any particular ethnic group and say, you know, they're a bad character or a good character because of their race or ethnicity, because you recognize that that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It does. And as you were saying that, there was a phrase from the course that is rather metaphysical, but I think is an interesting phrase that kind of encapsulates the idea that we're trying to get back to is, and it's talking about perfect oneness and something about I forget the exact phraseology, but something about like, no part sufficiently distinct, in order to, I think that's from the Forgotten Son, if I'm not mistaken, that, you know, there's no part that's sufficiently distinct from any other part to make the difference as a big deal. And I that's totally paraphrased, but I think that's the idea is, you know, if we can remember that to look past the surface doesn't mean we deny the sensory data, but we see beyond that, see through the dream, through the movie, the illusion, the nightmare, the craziness, to the underlying piece behind it, and then it's easier then to see the intrinsic sameness that leads to the unity. And I think that's why the shared interest is and following our inner kindness teacher is so important in our forgiveness classroom here. So I'll read that third paragraph here. This is again from question number 1174 in the FAQ of facimoutreach.org to wrap this up. To follow the path of the course's teachings, it is enough to be willing to notice how important it is to perceive difference. One of the goals of the course is to teach us to see all these differences for what they are, weapons of the ego's defense strategy, and not to be deceived by the, quote, beauty, unquote, of the world's kaleidoscope. Hidden behind the glitz is the fear of peace, and behind that fear is the fear of the oneness of God's love that we share. The hope of finding the true peace we seek, not to be confused with the bodily feeling of calm relaxation, begins with realizing we are afraid of it and have buried the fear beneath layers of denial. This realization opens the door to releasing the fear that blocks the peace. The beginning of healing is to cease denying the sickness. That is why much of the course is devoted to exposing the ego's use of fear as defense against the peace of God. When we are no longer afraid of it, it will no longer be perceived as a threat. And there's a quote here from chapter 12 in the text, section 2, paragraph, sentence 5. And that concludes with this quote. When we have overcome fear, not by hiding it, not by minimizing it, and not by denying its full import in any way, this, and then in brackets, peace, is what you will really see. And that's it. I mean, we just have to look at it. And I think that's why I'm so appreciative of Ken Wapnick's teachings, because he comes at that from so many different angles, is that it's not sinful, it's not evil, it's not wicked, it's just silly. And the only way we're going to reach that conclusion with peace as the outcome is by looking at the insanity of the ego, looking without condemnation at our inner drones and at our inner missiles and our attack thoughts and the craziness that we by default perceive everything in the world with this range that spans from suspiciousness to viciousness is the ego's insanity, and just begin to laugh at it gently and not in any kind of derisive way, but just say, wow, that's not working. Why would I want to go there again? It's failed me countless times. Why would I want to pick up that sword one more time and threaten myself with it, you know, and seemingly destroy my peace with that hostility, that condemnation. Yeah. So
it's just insane until you know it's insane.
Yeah.
You think it's sane.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you, Lynn. I always enjoy sharing an hour plus. Lately seems like it's been creeping over an hour just because we have so much to share. But enjoy the time sharing with you, and hopefully everyone else listening has found it useful too, because I sure do, because I remind myself of all the stuff that I need to practice throughout the day and by starting the weekend off this way.
Me too, and I really enjoy it tremendously because it starts early in the morning. And you're back in California now?
I will be actually heading back to Colorado in September. So my mom has recovered enough to where it's time for me to get back to the home turf and be back in Colorado. And so it's about
very
mid-September.
Cool.
I'll be heading back, give or take. So I haven't set a date yet exactly, but that's the plan. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, maybe you'd be thinking about coming to our fall retreat, which is in October. In Colorado Springs at the Franciscan Retreat Center.
Oh, okay.
So it's going to be pretty cool. It's got John Mark Stroud is going to be there, and Brent Haskell is going to be there.
Oh,
so,
I think I saw that. That's great.
Yeah. So you might consider coming down and hanging out with us, and I think it's going to be really good. I think it's going to be really good. So
what are the
it's just down the road. Let me look real quick here.
Okay.
I'll bring it up and then go ahead.
While you're doing that, I'll make another quick announcement since we're being generous with our time. There's also in October the third annual Miracle Share virtual conference that's happening the 21st through the 23rd of October, and I'm happy to report that I'm going to be participating again the third year as one of the sharers, if you will, and so I'll be doing a half hour video with the follow up of a half hour live FAQ Q&A via phone, and so it's basically a 3-day conference. And if you go to acimblog.com, I've got it in the upcoming events category, a link to a full article there. It's in the upper left-hand corner of acimblog.com. And I think it's going to be a blast, as it was the last 2 years. And this year, Cindy Laura Renard is going to be part of it, because Gary, I think, is going to be traveling that weekend. Anyway, there's just a lot of great course teachers in that one as well. So if you want to check that out, just go to acimblog.com, and it's in the upcoming events in the upper left corner of the site there, and you can learn more about it. And it's always a lot of fun.
Very
and
cool.
I listened to all the presentations this year, and they're all really good. So yeah, highly recommend it.
And that's our friend Craig Villarubia, who we just were with in Estes Park, and Corinne Zupko, and who's the other person who's involved in that?
Danielle Scruton.
Anyway,
the three of them have done just a great job with these three online conferences, and you can save on the gas and the time and the airfare and the car rental and the lodging and all that stuff. That's the beauty of a virtual conference. Exactly. And it's set up in such a way that you don't have to, you know, it's because it's virtual, you know, you can watch it later if you happen to be busy that weekend and anytime for, you know, a year or so after, you know, so, which is cool.
Yeah. And I've heard some really good teachings on that as well. So I'm glad that you brought that up. And also I just posted your ACIonblog.com. Yeah, people can go there and listen to replays of this recording as well. So that's always cool. So our fall retreat is October 23rd to the 27th is Regina.
Oh, okay.
And then October 28th is Brent Haskell. And then the 28th through the 30th is John Mark Stroud.
Oh, okay.
So, so that's, you know, three, I think, really dynamite presenters. And so if you're interested in it, it's a gorgeous place, the Franciscan Retreat Center there in Colorado Springs.
Nice.
So please think about joining us there.
Is it possible?
Anyway,
is it possible?
So much.
Oh, just real quick. Is it possible to attend just, you know, single days on that as well? Or?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, there is.
Oh, great. Okay.
So, yeah, because it's right down the road from you.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It wouldn't
I might
be
just
like
pop down for a day or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Cool. Well, thanks again.
And it's in your all. Yeah. Well, thank you, Bruce. And, you know, you might think about coming on the Friday that Brent Haskell is doing his thing. So.
Yeah, that's what I can, in fact. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. All righty. Well, I love you, Bruce. I'm glad your mother's getting better. That is a real joy to hear.
It is.
In many, many, many ways. Anyway, thank you so much, Bruce. I love you dearly, and talk to you next week.
Have a great one, everyone.
All right. Bye-bye, all.